snapped his spine at the same time. Pilgrim Boone didn't need any more chilling after that. When I found him laying at the bottom of the stairs, the bastard's neck was stretched 2 feet long. You were dumb not to chill old Wicklaw when you had the chance. You could be having his women, one after another, right now. You could be living in his rooms down on the third floor.
The smell of the food wafting through the kitchen doorway made Ryan's mouth water and started his stomach rumbling.
We didn't see any gaudies when we came into town.
No gaudies here. This is a dry veal. Jolt and Juice don't grow food. They eat a man's strength.
No trained sluts either?
Oh, there's sluts, but none for rent, only for trade. We pilgrims prize our wives above everything else. That's what Bob and Edith taught us.
Prize? Not respect, not honor, not cherish? Women as fucking livestock.
We've never heard of Bob and Enid. Just who might they be?
Plavik smiled at Christy. It was a question he relished answering.
Bob and Enid were the ones who came first, right after the waters fell away. They brought with them the greatest wisdom of the world before Skydark. They used it to give shape and balance to this paradise. We praise their memories every single day.
This great wisdom you mention, might I inquire as to its substance?
It took a second or two for Plavik to sift the meaning from the old man's somewhat tortured Victorian construction.
Bob and Enid, may they abide in glory, carried knowledge of all things on the earth, and of the inner workings of all things down to the tiniest speck of dust.
They were white coats, then?
From the expression in Plavik's dark protruding eyes, J.B.'s suggestion bordered on blasphemy.
They were seekers after truth. They were pilgrims in a ruined land, as are we.
Okay, Bob and Enid weren't white coats, but there were white coats in Little Pueblo before Nuke Day.
Plavik gave him a blank look.
That's one of their complexes in the middle of the square. We walk right past it. Nothing like that's been built since Armageddon.
Oh, you're mistaken. That's the tomb of Bob and Enid, a monument to their sacred memory.
His absurd answer hung in the air for a moment, before Ryan pressed the issue.
A tomb and not a temple? You never go down there to make your praise?
Oh, that would be sacrilege. The tomb is sealed for all time. It cannot be defiled.
Their interest in the redoubt was clearly starting to aggravate Plavik, so Mildred changed the subject.
We followed a man here, picked up his trail in the canyon, tracked him almost to the outskirts of the ville. We figured he was 2 or 3 days ahead of us. You know who I'm talking about?
No. You're the first newcomers to show up in more than a month.
Perhaps the man never made it. Maybe he died before he got here.
Even if the pilgrim hadn't looked down and to the left as he spoke, the classic tell of a man who was lying, Ryan wouldn't have believed him. The thief had to have arrived in Little Pueblo. Why Plavik would bother to lie about it was the mystery. Plavik's quartet of wives swept into the room, carrying the food in a hodgepodge of serving containers. Chipped ceramic bowls, handleless mugs, and metal saucepots brimmed with a thick steaming soup. One of the women offered them rounds of golden fry bread from a heaping wicker basket. The soup was corn-based, Swedish-tasting, with bits of chicken meat and flavored with chili spice. Ryan had to force himself to eat slowly to avoid scalding his mouth. As he dipped the fry bread into his pot, he looked more closely at the women and kids. Plavik's oldest wife was in her mid-twenties. None of the children were older than 6 or 7. They all resembled their pa. Same dark, thick hair, same intense dark eyes. Plavik's women didn't look at their husband straight on while they served the meal, but they weren't scared to death like Jubilee. Maybe because they were sitting on top of the shit pile. As more fry bread was passed around, Plavik turned to Ryan.
Now it's you folks' turn to talk. Tell me about yourselves. I want to hear everything. Where did you come from? Where were you headed?
Taking a page from his host's book, Ryan smiled and lied through his teeth. Mildred Wyeth used the razor point of her knife to cut a slit in the sheet plastic that blocked the second-story City Hall window. Outside, night had fallen on Little Pueblo. There were firelights here and there around the town square, dancing in the doorways of the occupied one-story buildings. Stars glittered overhead. No one moved in the faint moonlight. It was very hot, and the air was dead still. The smell of wood smoke hung like a pall. Looking out at the surrounding blackness, the valley floor and the canyon walls, Mildred got a powerful, disturbing sense of Little Pueblo's precarious grip on existence. It was like a ship far out on a storm-tossed sea, floating rudderless at the whim of fate. Jubilee stood at her side, mute, expressionless. Mildred had tried her best, using the gentlest possible approach, but she hadn't been able to break through to the child or to get her to respond in any way. It wasn't catatonia, Mildred was sure of that. Jubilee knew what was going on around her. Mildred would have felt better if there had been tears, screaming, even violence. Anything but this blankness.
Mildred?
Mildred looked over her shoulder at him. He waved for her to join him and the others in a circle on the floor. She started to lead Jubilee over, too.
No, not her. She can stay right there.
Mildred understood Ryan's reasoning. They didn't know if they could trust the girl yet. There was a slim chance that she wasn't as incapacitated as she looked, but she was biding her time, looking for an opportunity to get herself back in the good graces of some other pilgrim, and perhaps return to the Vill's fold. If she overheard their plan, she could betray them.
Everyone sit close and keep your voices low. We don't know who's listening.
What do you make of all this, Ryan?
Bug Eyes was feeding us a load of bullshit, JB. The water thief got here all right. We were following his tracks. If he'd dropped dead in them, we'd have found the body. There was no reason for Plevic to lie about our chiller friend, unless something bad happened to him. Something that wasn't an accident. Something Plevic thought we wouldn't take kindly to.
And he was lying about Minotaur, too. A tomb, my ass.
But it was sealed up like one. Remember how that door was blocked?
Well, we'll unblock it in a little while. As soon as we're sure everyone's sound asleep.
Our host's protests notwithstanding, the much-revered Bob and Enid were most definitely of the white coat persuasion.
Yeah, they had to be, Doc. They were here first because they walked out of that redoubt when the water level dropped.
Atlantis becomes Eden. A veritable dog's dinner, mythologically speaking.
Worthy of a Disney Channel.
No one got the joke, of course. Of the companions, only Mildred had subscribed to cable TV and found nothing to watch on 150 stations.
So, how did Eden pop up here? Sure, there's water, but look at what else these people have. Grain crops, vegetables, bees, chickens.
The seeds could have been carried across the desert, but not the bees or the chickens. No way would they have survived the heat. There's only one place they could have come from, and that's Minotaur.
The redoubt's emergency processed food supplies would have run out a long time ago. Whoever designed Minotaur was looking at the big picture, at building some kind of permanent settlement here.
But they didn't know when Skydark might happen. Even small livestock takes up room, requires food, makes a mess, and tends to multiply. How do you store bees and chickens indefinitely?
Cryogenically, using liquid nitrogen. Compared to defrosting and reanimating a human being, a chicken is a piece of cake. Believe me, I've done both.
Or the bees and chickens could have been mad-transed in from some other location after the new cost.
I like the sound of that better. Means the damn thing works.
Or at least it worked once.
It would appear that Eden is the product of much careful consideration, right down to the bees necessary for proper pollination of their crops.
They planned out the community structure here, too. They knew that Little Pueblo, post-apocalypse, wasn't going to be a closed system with a static population. Every once in a while, newcomers would show up out of the desert and have to be assimilated. There had to be a procedure for that in place. Also a procedure for removing excess people. Overpopulation would destroy everything.
So what keeps everyone in line? There are only 6 pilgrims. They've got no blasters that we've seen. There aren't teams of enforcers to make the people obey. As big and mean as the pilgrims are, they couldn't turn back a mob with their bare hands.
I think it has to do with this place. About what it is, where it is, and what's all around it.
Death all around.
Probably some years there's a lot less of it to go around. It's in everyone's interest to follow the rules. A pilgrim might get chilled and replaced, but that doesn't change anything. The system is still in place. Lots of single males at the bottom, and a few pilgrims at the top.
And there's hope built in, even for the field slaves. Plavik's an example of that.
I agree about the stability of the pecking order, but I think you're missing something important.
What's that, Mildred?
There isn't just one efficient way to organize this place. Sure. Simple works best when it comes to social order, but I can think of a dozen other plans that make as much sense, given the elements we've seen here.
Why don't the single men get together and rearrange things so they all have wives, or at least access to them?
That's what I mean. They've got everything to gain from kicking ass, and they've got the means to do it, but they're docile as sheep. We're missing something.
What I want to know is, what happened to Pilgrim Boone's children?
You're right. Those kids were definitely Plavik's. They looked just like him. If this place is all about certain people making babies, what happened to Boone's?
It's basic Darwinism, I'm afraid. In a system like this, with a handful of alpha males in charge of all the females, it isn't unusual for the new male harem master to kill all the offspring who aren't his. This improves the chances of his kids, his genes, to survive.
And the women who mothered those kids would stand still for that?
They wouldn't have any choice. They might have even helped. In a situation like this, you can't discount the women as just being downtrodden and helpless victims. They can be as determined and deadly as the dominant males. Together, the females form a kind of sub-clan that functions and survives in support of whatever male who happens to be in charge at the moment. Their real allegiance is to the sub-clan, to one another.
There seems to be a dearth of graybeards on the premises.
Maybe they're chilling the oldies, too.
What you mean is, they're killing their own fathers and mothers.
Like killing one's offspring, that's a very difficult proposition for a human being. Historically speaking, it's only been done in extreme circumstances, in times of starvation or disaster, which obviously isn't what's going on here. There's plenty of everything.
Why haven't they tried to chill us? Because we've got blasters and grins?
Or maybe because we have you and Mildred. Women are status here. They're treating us like we're not quite pilgrims.
Ryan looked over at Jubilee. She stood by the window, staring out at the night.
That one could tell us a lot.
If she were talking.
Because her back was to the newcomers, Jubilee couldn't make out their words. She wasn't really trying to hear what they were saying anyway. It was all wasted effort. There was nothing they could do, or plan to do, that would change anything. And there was nothing she could do to go back to the way things were. She breathed in the familiar smells of the night. Wood smoke, chili spice, wet earth from the lake. And as she did, the aching pain in her throat became almost unbearable. No tears came, though. She had no more tears left. She had every reason to believe that this was her last night on earth, that she would die without ever seeing her baby's face. Like the one-eyed man and his male friends, she was the walking dead. Their two women companions still had a few good years left by Little Pueblo standards, unless they proved difficult. Jubilee knew all about the consequences of being difficult. That's what got her put on the trading block. She wasn't submissive enough to suit Wicklaw. She asked him questions. It was automatic in her nature. And when she didn't like the answers he gave her, she asked him more questions. It was a recipe for disaster. Her sister Wicklaw Wives had taken her aside numerous times and tried to explain to her that despite the way things looked on the surface, the women of the Ville really controlled everything. They said they all just pretended to be weak in order to rule behind the scenes. The idea rang false to her, as it had when her own mother had first told her the same thing years ago. Her mother, who had been cold at age 29, after birthing 15 children, for four pilgrims. The power over life and death wasn't in the hands of the womenfolk. The way Jubilee saw it, no one in Little Pueblo was in control. They were all prisoners, all condemned, all awaiting execution. Before the afternoon's assembly, the word on her prickly attitude had gotten around to the other pilgrims through the wife's grapevine. She knew in advance that no one was going to trade for her. Not today, not ever. In Little Pueblo, not fit to trade meant not fit to live. For a moment in the movie house, when the strangers had their grins out and were threatening the entire Ville with destruction, she wanted to scream out, "Do it! Chill them all before they chill you!" The words had died in her throat. She was 13 years old, she was pregnant, and she had no faith in grins or the threats of strangers. Calling out for blood would have only sped up her own end. Keeping quiet meant a few more minutes of agony-free life for her and her unborn baby. Jubilee Wicklaw felt the one-eyed man approach her from behind. She couldn't escape him any more than she could escape her own fate, so she didn't try. He came close, but he didn't touch her. He spoke, in a low, soothing voice.
Look, I promise not to hurt you or the baby. I just need some questions answered. Like how this place works.
Jubilee had seen strangers wander in from the desert many times before, but never any quite like these. Dangerous people, skilled fighters, arriving in a squad, not in ones or twos. And the women were as hard as the men, and in the same way.